How could you possibly have a radio show during Valentine's week without a little romance? And who better to talk with when romance is involved than Afton's Jo Bourne, or Joanna Bourne, as she is known to her many readers. Jo, you see, writes seriously award-winning romance novels that garner comments such as this one from the website All About Romance. Once in a while, during every reader's literary life, you encounter a book that reminds you why you are a reader. It renews your faith, if faith was lost. It rekindles your interest, if interest waned. And every word, every page is a wonder. Adrian and Justine's story is such a book, and it confirms Joanna Bourne is one of the best authors currently writing. If Ms. Bourne continues writing at such quality, she would deserve to be called one of the greatest romance authors ever. And I mean that. Well, without further ado, I thought we should start off our visit with Jo Bourne by having her read a snippet from the novel that garnered that praise.
Oh, fine romance, my good fellow, this is a fine romance.
We see Justine and Hawker at various stages in their life. This is when they are 15 or 16, and Justine has snuck into England so that she can see her sister, who has been adopted by an English couple. And leaving there, she runs into Hawker. He was also associated with this English couple. And Hawker has a gamekeeper's cabin, which is on the estate of this couple. And they go back there together, as I say.
How Lady Chatterley.
I think so, yes. Old friends and old enemies. So there they are. It's raining outside, and they are inside. She, Justine, lifted the teapot so he could turn scoops of leaves in. He had artist's hands, sculptor's hands. Such hands are not delicate and white with long fingers. They are strong, precise, exact, and purposeful. His chin was shadowed with a need to shave. She had known a boy 3 years ago. She did not really know this young man. I do not know how to ask. Everything I can say is ugly. I do not want this to be ugly. She gave her attention to pouring hot water onto the tea leaves. Rain drummed on the roof. Since they were not talking, since they were not looking at each other, it seemed very loud. He said, "As soon as you drink that, you should leave. It's getting worse out there." "I must do this now before I lose my courage. I am hoping to spend the night." She chose words carefully to clarify matters beyond any possibility of misunderstanding. "It is my wish to spend the night with you in your bed." There, she had said it. It was now too late to take it back. Her mind, which had many cowardly corners, immediately went looking for plausible ways to pretend she did not mean what she had said. Hawker was silent. He would have been this self-possessed if tribesmen of the Afghan plains had burst through the door and attacked him with scimitars. This refusal to be ruffled was one of his least endearing traits. Time stretched, very empty of comment, while she swirled the teapot gently, and he was inscrutable. Finally, he took the oil lamp from the end of the mantel and busied himself adjusting the wick, lighting it with a paper spill from the fire. "The hell you say?" "But yes, that is what the hell I say. You need not treat this as an inconvenient importunity. Even you do not have hordes of women proposing to share your bed." I expected him to be stupidly pleased. Instead, he was suspicious of me. "I will pour you tea, yes? Thank you." "You need not thank me. It is your own tea, after all." Once she could have offered him an explicit choice of sexual acts in 6 languages. Now she had no words. She could not even call to mind the French ones. She lifted the lid of the pot. "I will add water. The tea is a little strong." A nod from him, and she did the pouring of hot water into the pot. Then she poured 2 cups of tea. "This time I will be in control. I will be the one with all the power. This is how I will free myself." Memory wriggled like dark worms at the edges of her mind. She pushed it away. He took the sugar bowl from the mantel and stood holding it. Do you want sugar?
It is kind of you to offer, yes.
I have silver tongs and spoons around here. Maggie keeps putting silver tableware in here, which is an incitement to threat if I've ever seen one. I shove them out of sight, and that blasted woman they send to clean goes and hides them somewhere else, just to make a point.
It is the subtle warfare of the servant classes. I am frequently a servant, so I sympathize.
She held up both cups resting in their saucers. Do not go seeking sugar tongs, which are probably well concealed. Two lumps for me. You may use your fingers. He slid two fingers into the bowl and brought out sugar lumps scissored between first and second finger, dropped one into his cup, deft and clever, two into hers. He never took his eyes off her face. You and me go to bed.
It was impossible to say anything.
She, who had mouthed so many unclean words, so many bawdy songs, poems, ditties, could not get that small yes off her tongue. You want to... He made a gesture, a rude one. She nodded. It's a dull day that doesn't bring some surprise.
Bravo! Is a fine romance.
You write for Avon?
No, right now I write for Berkeley. My first book was published by Avon many years ago.
I beg your pardon.
Back when there were still pterodactyls flying in the sky. Now I write for Berkeley, which is part of Penguin.
You write for Berkeley, part of Penguin. What do they want from you? What kind of parameters do they give you? What's your mandate?
My mandate is spelled out by two things. Firstly, I have a contract, and the contract will contain language that says you will deliver this manuscript of this kind, historical romance, of this length. 120,000 words on this date, and they will give a date. It's usually part of a three-part deal where you are expected to first come up with a synopsis or working outline so they know what they're buying. Secondly, you deliver a manageable manuscript. Mm-hmm. Then you, after they've come back and said, remove chapters 11 through 19 and put something else in. After they've done this to you, then you come back with a sort of a negotiated manuscript. Although I have to say, I have one of the world's great editors, and anything she has ever said has always been right, useful, helpful. It has improved the book.
You want to mention names?
Yeah, this is Wendy McCurdy. This is Wendy McCurdy, who is an old timer in the New York publishing business and who is just first rate at what she does. Great, great editor.
What a pleasure.
It is. It is. Well, the thing is, I wouldn't keep signing with Berkeley if Berkeley was not treating me right.
Where are you in what cycle right at the moment?
The last contract I signed was for two books. I am busily in the middle of writing the first book. And we'll turn that in, and we'll then give them a synopsis saying what the second book is. I hope by the time I have to do that, I know what the second book is.
Sublime romance with no kisses. A fine romance, my friend. This is, we two should be like clams in a dish of chowder. What we just fizz like parts of a settler's powder. Yes,
this is a fine romance.
Back after a break to talk further with the author of that steamy prose, romance writer Joanna Bourne. Back before the break, we heard Joanna Bourne read from her award-winning historical romance novel, Black Hawk. And speaking of hawks, Joanna currently lives and writes in what sounds like her own Afton Airy.
I live way up on Elk Mountain. If I ran straight off the cliff like, you know, Wile E. Coyote and just kept going, I would fall down onto like the Afton Post Office or something.
No kidding.
It's very pretty, but I'm more or less straight up above it. I look down and I can see all the way to the next ridge of mountains to the east.
And what led you to move there?
I have always wanted to live in the middle of nowhere. I've always wanted to retreat from the world. Now, I am not mentally and morally and emotionally suited to be a cloistered nun. Not being Catholic has something to do with this, yeah. But I couldn't do this because I kept having, like, kids. And I would say to my kids, hey, you want to go move up into a mountain where everybody is 40 minutes drive away? And for some reason, they have said no.
How many kids do you have?
I have two. They are grown up now, which is why I'm now living up on top of a mountain. And the last one went off to college. She's up in New York City. She could not wait to shake the dust of Charlottesville off of her boots.
And how long were you in Charlottesville?
Well, I first came to Charlottesville, more than 30 years ago. And it has always been home base. But I was in the Foreign Service. And the Foreign Service picks you out of the United States. That's the diplomatic corps. That's the Department
of
State.
Did you work at that building downtown?
There is a building downtown. That is part of the government, but it is not part of the Department of State.
All right.
It's that spooky stuff there. Whereas the Department of State just does diplomacy in a very dull way. I didn't do diplomacy myself. The Department of State has a number of elite people who do diplomacy, and they meet with foreign heads of state, and they drink cocktails with them. And then they also have people who run around and make sure the cars are parked in a straight line, and that was more or less what I did.
And so you were in and out of Charlottesville?
It was my official home port, but I spent virtually all of my time outside the country.
Okay.
When my son came to the United States, he'd been there as a baby. He came to the United States, and we'd been in Africa. We'd been in West Africa, in Nigeria, city of Lagos. Lagos is not one of the world's great tourist destinations. It's a strange place, and he had never seen, for instance, the moon, because you don't go out at night. Do you know how you don't get malaria if you're in West Africa? You stay in behind screens after it gets dark. He'd never seen a traffic light. He'd never seen an escalator. He'd never seen a drinking fountain.
How old was he?
He's about 5.
Wow.
I went to Georgetown University in Washington, and I was a TA while I was getting my graduate degree. Got a master's.
In biology?
In biology. In okay. Mammalian physiology.
Okay.
Ask me anything.
Well, I want to know how you got from there to parking cars at the State Department.
The State Department, to be a Foreign Service officer, and I was indeed a Foreign Service officer, to be a Foreign Service officer is actually rather difficult. You take a written exam, highly competitive written exam, 1 in 100 pass. And then you take an oral exam where there's this panel of people and they ask you things. You know, what would you do if? And you get to make up stuff. You get to say, oh, I would handle it in a really intelligent fashion instead of saying, oh, I would panic completely and run, which is more the truth. So you pass that. And then they spend 2 years putting you through a clearance process to make certain that, for instance, your fourth grade teacher was not a communist sympathizer or, and you know, who knows. Takes them a long time to do this, whatever they do. And then they come back and they say, yes, we will give you a job where you will earn less money than anybody else you know and live under miserable conditions and occasionally get shot at. And you say, yes.
And why did you say yes? And I have to say, both your arms went out to embrace this memory.
How else could you live such an interesting life?
Bingo.
Now, I will say that for writing, everybody does research for writing, and a lot of the research that you do when you are writing is this is stuff that you have lived. It's little tiny things that you put in your writing. For instance, you are at the window, and it's nighttime, and you look out, and you see a little bit of what's outside the window, but you also see your own self reflected back holding a candle. Robert Frost said this. He said that poets are people who live more intensely than other people. They kind of notice what is going on. This is, you can tell me, kind of paraphrasing what he said. So a writer does that. A writer lives every moment and sees and remembers it.
In detail.
In detail, in visual detail, and in words, so that you have that image of yourself standing, looking out a window, holding a candle with you and a candle, and the moon outside, and the shadows of the trees,
all of them there in that one picture, okay? When people are writing historical fiction, which is I'm writing, I have seen a medieval market. I have seen a abattoir, a slaughterhouse, the way somebody would see in the 12th century, because I've been in West Africa. I have been in a society where you take your daughter, who is just dressed up to the nines, and you don't let her sit down because she'll wrinkle the dress, and she goes and she dances with somebody there in the middle, and men are watching and saying, is this the one I want for my wife? And you're going to marry that daughter off to somebody 15, 20 years older than she is, who's maybe seen her in a dance room. I have been at a Regency ball because I've been in Iran. I've lived history by being overseas.
That is so cool. When did you start writing it?
Well, I have always been a storyteller. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that when you talk about writing fiction, if you're writing genre, what you are is you're not so much a writer as you are a storyteller. And story is what you're doing.
Define genre. Tell me, what do you mean genre. By genre?
Okay. Once upon a time, there was a bookstore. And a guy who owned a bookstore said, how will I help everybody who comes into my bookstore find the books that they want? Now, if he had been selling groceries, he would have said, I'm going to put all the soup here and I'm going to market soup. And I'm going to put the vegetables over there and I'm going to market some vegetables. And so tomato soup is on this aisle, and tomatoes in a little can that looks just like tomato soup, and it's exactly the same as tomato soup, I'm going to mark tomato sauce, and I'm going to put it in an entirely different, and people are going to come to me, especially the people who grow tomatoes, and they're going to say, why have you put me with the soup instead of with the Italian condiments? And I'm going to say, because that's where the reader comes to look for it. Genre is a book-selling term. It's not something the librarians made up. It's not something writers didn't make this up. It's not something that some research person at the university made up. This is a book-selling term. It is, if somebody's looking for one, where do they expect to find the one that's most like it? And that's what genre is. Mystery, horror, westerns, romantic comedy, romance, ethnic romance, paranormal romance, historical romance, contemporary romance, science fiction, science fantasy, all of them are exactly where the reader comes in and expects to find them, unless she has gone into something like Barnes & Noble, where she's going to have trouble finding any books at all.
You sure you want to take a whack at Barnes & Noble?
I love Barnes & Noble. Barnes & Noble is so kind to me. I love them. Hey, I love you, Barnes & Noble.
But you'll still take a whack. Okay, I made you digress just to define what you meant by genre when you were talking about becoming a writer.
Yes. Genre stories tell story. A genre book, almost the easiest way you can define it is saying, this is a book, and if you look between the covers, you're going to find a story. This is not true of nonfiction, and it's not true of literary fiction, which is doing other important and wonderful things, but it is not primarily telling story. Story is just magical. Story is, there is some discussion about what is the oldest profession? And I am going to say that the oldest profession is storytelling.
That's wonderful. Coming from a romance novelist.
Coming from a romance novelist, storytelling is the oldest profession. This is why we have language. You do not need language to organize a hunt. All of these male anthropologists will talk about language comes from the need of the tribe to organize a hunt. Obviously, if they were biologists, they would know that lionesses and wolves organize hunts just fine, and their vocabulary is very limited. You do not need words to say, danger, 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 Will Robinson. You don't need this. You have mockingbirds that can not only say, hey, look out, something's coming. They can say, in an absolutely predictable way, they can say, Mrs. Jones's cat with the lop ear is underneath the hydrangeas. Watch out. And they can say that. We don't need language to say that. What we need language to say is, it's okay, Mom, nothing happened. Or else, everybody's wearing them this length, Mom. Or, I was working late at the office. That's why we need language to tell lies. And story is telling lies, and you can't do it without language.
So when did you commence telling stories or telling lies, ma'am?
I used to line up my dolls. adults, and I would tell them stories. And I had a younger sister, 2 years younger than I was, and if she didn't crawl away fast enough, by golly, I would tell her stories too, and the cat.
So when did this become a profession, and how did it become a profession?
Once upon a time, long, long ago, in a distant land called Charlottesville, I had a child, and I stayed home with the child, and I slowly went mad. Soon, I was talking to the dogs and the cats.
I did the same thing in Charlottesville.
Yes, is what it is. If you're going to be a writer, you move to Charlottesville. So I said, no, I did not say, hey, look, I can write a book just as good as these. But I said, I like to read these books. I'll bet you I could write one. And I did.
Now, by these books?
Romances.
Romances.
Yes, I wrote a Regency historical romance. That was back in 1983.
You've been at this for a while.
No, I have not.
Okay.
I wrote that book, got that book published. I have to tell you, there's out on the net, there are huge websites and blogs and forum boards devoted to how do you get published.
Yeah.
And they will talk about query letters. And they will, endlessly. I wrote this book. I typed it. A typewriter, for those of you who've never heard of a typewriter, it's this thing and you poke keys, but it doesn't have a screen. It's just the paper comes out where you'd expect the screen to be. And there was something called whiteout. And you don't, it's really painful. You don't need to know this. So I wrote this book on a typewriter with a carbon. And I sent it out and I put a little thing on top of it saying, I just wrote this book. I hope you like it. I've enclosed 3 chapters. And I really like chapter 7, chapter 11, and chapter 28. So those are the ones I send. You don't do this. You send the first 3 chapters. And I sent it off to the first of my list. And my list was alphabetical. And anyhow, it went to Avon and they published it. They were very, very kind.
Did they ask for the rest of it?
I sent the whole thing. I didn't send them a query letter. I just sent them the manuscript. As I said, you know, they didn't have the World Wide Web. I didn't know that RWA existed. It may not have existed at that time.
RWA?
Romance Writers of America, the big organization in the United States for romance writers. It's got like 8,000 or 10,000 members. It's a big thing.
It's a big deal.
It is a big deal.
So you published your first, what was the name of it?
This was Her Ladyship's Companion.
A rough plot synopsis?
Oh, it was very gothic. The young governess comes to the house on the cliffs of Cornwall.
In what year?
Ooh, 1818.
Okay.
And is menaced by someone who is trying to kill the young earl, who's about 7 years old. And she falls in love with his uncle. And of course, you know, they have the happy ending, and it's really very nice. It actually introduced one of the characters who became part of my more important works, which were much, much later. Because after I published that one, the kid grew up and I went back to work almost immediately, even before it came out. And I stopped writing books because I was really very busy. And I didn't write books for 20 more years, came back and wrote my next one in 2008. That's more than 20 years, isn't it?
That is more than 20 years.
It was, and for a long time, that book was unavailable, the first one.
Okay.
People were asking ridiculous amounts of money for it on, you know, just it was just stupid.
Because it was great.
No, I have no idea why they were doing it. But I said, the heck with this, and I put it out as an e-publication. So that is available if anyone wants to see the very, very first appearance in print of Sir Adrian Hawkehurst, who shows up in the 4 other books that have been put out. Those have been put out by Berkeley. And when I wanted to sell those, I knew how you were supposed to do it now. So I
did you play by the rules?
I played by the rules.
I'm so impressed.
So that is how I started writing. All of the years that I was working for the government, for the State Department, I was doing a lot of writing. But it was what we like to think of as nonfiction. And that teaches you also.
You are so funny.
My books are very amusing.
Are they?
In an ironic and wry and witty way.
My romance doesn't need a castle rising in Spain, nor a dance to a constantly surprising refrain. Wide awake, I can make my most fantastic dreams come true. My romance doesn't need a thing but you.
Historical romance novelist Joanna Bourne will be appearing at this year's Virginia Festival of the Book. You'll find information about her appearance, as well as a link to Joanna's website, on the Spark page at WMRA.org. The Spark is a joint production of the WMRA Land Community and the staff of WMRA Public Radio. The Spark's theme music is supplied by the Avant Gardeners of Albemarle County. Terry Ward is our web wrangler. Thanks to Bob, Matt, and Terry for their help. And special thanks to Teresa Curry for letting me know about historical romance novelist Joanna Bourne. So whom do you know or know of that I should talk to on the Spark? Please send me a note about all your Sparky friends, relatives, and acquaintances through the Spark page at WMRA.org. I'm Martha Woodruff. It's been a great pleasure to be with you.